Matters of diversity, equity, and inclusion are often considered central to student affairs work, and I couldn't think of any more experienced or more visionary person to discuss this topic with than Vernon Wall. Vernon is a well-known and experienced social justice educator, and I suspect he's been on more college campuses than anyone else in the student affairs world as he conducts his social justice consulting work. I've had the pleasure of knowing Vernon for many years, and I appreciate his thoughtful way of engaging his audiences and his colleagues to grow in their understanding of how to exercise social justice in their work and in their lives. I'm grateful to Vernon for taking time out of his schedule to share his thoughts on the future of student affairs.
Maybe you could just start out by talking a little bit about what your current work is.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting because I always list leadership as sort of my number one gig right now, but I'm really only part-time. I mean, but it's a full-time experience to work with a wonderful group of staff that, you know, develops programs and experiences for students around leadership development. So that's you know, my title is director of business development. So I'm sort of the, if there is a salesperson within our team, I'm that person who basically pulls in more business from campus partners to host many of our programs. Our 6-day signature institute is what most people know, but then we also have some 1-day programs, Catalyst and Resilience. And then we also have some virtual experiences because, of course, like everyone else, as soon as COVID hit, we had to reframe how we did the work. And so we've got Courageous Dialogue, which is a great sort of 3-hour program to get people to engage. Basically gives us some principles around what is courageous dialogue. And Living in Possibility is another online experience. So yeah. And then I'm one of the founding faculty members of the Social Justice Training Institute way back in 1998, when Kathy O'Bear, Jamie Washington, Mark Cullen, and I got together and said, hey, you know, we really did it because we thought about the fact that we were out here doing some work around, at that time, diversity and multiculturalism was the terminology. And we were thinking, well, how do we know that we are skilled to do this? It was the beginnings of the only program in higher education, master's program in social justice, which was at UMass Amherst, where Dr. Bailey Jackson and his colleagues were. So that was really the only program that sort of taught the principles of equity and inclusion. And so we thought, well, we need to, in higher education, be about preparing us to be better. And so that's how that all started. And then, yes, I have my One Better World LLC, which has been around for a while, but that's what the umbrella that I use for the keynotes and presentations that I do when I'm traveling.
Yeah, one thing, as you talk about that and talk about, I mean, I know you've been in the field for a few decades, and you've been, I know even when we were graduate students together at the University of Georgia, you were traveling around some. And I guess one thing that stands out to me is that, I don't know, there are probably a few people in the field who have visited as many campuses as you have, Vernon. I mean, you know, you've seen a lot, you've talked to so many people and all kinds of different institutions and regions of the country and all that. And I guess it's one reason that I think I'm really interested in your perspective on these things related to the project that I'm interested in, which is the future of student affairs. And I guess one question that I'd like to ask you is, what are some big questions you have as you look ahead to the future of student affairs?
You know, a few things. One is our campuses will continue to grapple with issues of inclusion. I want us to see it as a process, not a goal. I think a lot of times when senior leaders are together, they're trying to look at how can we eradicate systemic oppression? Or how can we develop an inclusive campus? Yes, that's an ideal, but that's a goal. And I think we need to work on the process because there can be small victories along the way. Because the reality is, It takes 7 to 10 years of intentional work within an organization for you to see change, which means most of us won't see it when we're at an institution unless we say over 10 years. And once again, it has to be sustained, systemic work, which barely happens. I always tell people that in, I believe in higher education, on most campuses, we have a timeshare in equity and inclusion. And what that means on that campus is you may have a good week or maybe even a month, but then it goes away because you're not, it's not ingrained into the institution in a way that allows for there to be systemic change. So, and I don't say that to be disheartening. I just say that to be real. Campuses are not in the, they're not, they don't see the benefit of continued systemic change. And I just read an article in the Chronicle, I think it was last month, maybe, great article that talked about right during all of the multiple pandemics that were happening last year and the year before, George Floyd murders, trans folks being murdered, you know, everything happening. They had great conversations with university presidents who basically said, here is what we're gonna do in the next 5 years. And they were, many of them, very bold, very intentional, saying, here's what we're gonna do. Now, last month, they did a follow-up with all of those presidents to say, tell us what you've done in the last 2 years. None of those presidents responded. Complete silence. And this is what the article talks about. It's a great article. It basically says rhetoric does not equal action. And so what happened was all of these presidents hired senior diversity officers or talked about the things that they were going to do, and none of it came to fruition. So now, of course, I'm sure there's been some small victories on campuses, but senior leaders just still don't. I think the big thing that I want people to hear when I'm doing my work this year is that equity and inclusion is a skill that we must develop. We're not born being inclusive. We're not born being about systemic social justice change. We're not. None of us are. But I think we think that either in student affairs, we're good people. So of course, we're going to be about social justice and equity and inclusion. Nope, it's not only about being good people. Or we're from a historically marginalized identity that we feel that we are about this because this is who we are. Mm-mm. We got to drop that. We got to learn the skills around inclusivity, like we do around supervision, like we do around advising student groups. We weren't born knowing how to supervise. We weren't born how to counsel and use helping skills. Same thing with equity and inclusion. We got to move to a point where everyone realizes that it's a skill that we develop and it's a lifelong skill that we develop.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up. And by the way, in terms of the language, you had mentioned we used to talk about diversity, and you're using the language of inclusion, social justice. This is for my own benefit. Maybe for all of us in our discourse. But could you talk about the language around that inclusion versus diversity and social justice, and how those ideas fit together?
Yeah, I mean, I think diversity is. You know, if we're honest about ourselves in higher education, diversity was about numbers. How many do we have? How many do we not have? Let's get more. Let's hope they don't leave. Let's keep them on campus. Thems were the historically marginalized identities. And then as we moved toward multiculturalism, that was about culture and understanding these people. Who are they? And by the way, they're not bad people. They're just like us. If we remember the quote unquote trainings that we had in the 80s and the 90s, they were all about, here's an identity group. Here's some snapshot into that identity group for those of you who aren't, and please accept them, which was much more of an assimilation model of accept them. They're just like us, which, not saying anything negative about diversity and multiculturalism, but let's be clear. That's what it was. It was about the other. It was about focusing on what we can do for the other, to the other. Programs and services, that's what we were doing. When Dr. Bailey Jackson and his colleagues at UMass Amherst asked us to move toward a social justice perspective, that means you engage, you understand who you are in the conversation before you engage the conversation. So you understand, like, what are my identities? How do they play into this conversation we're going to have, whether it be on race or on class or on social or on ability or nationality or gender? So yeah, so that's where the social justice piece comes in. It's the focus is much more on personal work before you then engage. And I use equity and inclusion now more because the term social justice has been misused a lot. And I think for some folks on college campuses, it's a little bit of a trigger because people see social justice equals action. And I don't want to, but the reality is there are two things that need to happen before action, and that's personal work, dialogue and skill building, then action. But a lot of time people see the term social justice and they go, oh, that means protests or that means some sort of action. But you can't get to the action piece until you do personal work and dialogue and skill building. You just can't, or you won't be successful. So that's why lately I've been using equity and inclusion just so, you know, because I know that for some people, their campuses aren't, that's not the language that you use. And we're in a political system. So we've got legislatures that are basically basically resistant to some of the work. And so how can we frame it in a way where we still do the great work and we allow for there to be critical voices in there, which I think they're important to have.
One thing, I mean, as you talked about, you know, some of those challenges around the politics of it, but actually even more so, I guess I'd want to go back to what you were saying around knowing, learning, you know, kind of before acting.
Right.
And one thing that as I hear you talk about that, it strikes me as I've sometimes been in workshops with you or Jamie Washington, and I have said this to you before, that I feel like I leave the room and everybody in there has in some way been challenged and in some way been supported, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, as a white straight male who has been, you know, part of this community for a long time. And I know I've left that always feeling this way. Like I love the challenge, mm-hmm. but I also love the idea that my identity has certain kinds of filters to it that are recognized and understood at some level, but also, you know, a little bit of shaken and challenging to look at that. And mm-hmm. so that's one thing I, you know, again, that I've really appreciated about the work you do. And hearing you talk right now about the reality, for instance, of the political environment too, is, understanding that broad brush, and yeah. that even the activists, even those who are ready for action, sometimes it's helpful to step back and look at things. Yeah, I was thinking, what, as I've taught sometimes multicultural student development theory or what we call diversity in American higher education, you know, a lot of our master's students in particular are looking for language and action, that things that are actionable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I always kind of feel like I want to orient them a little bit to think about the complexities of intercultural,
yeah.
You know, interaction and understanding. So like in Honduras, one of my best laboratories is going to Honduras, and we go to small villages mm-hmm. there. And I mean, prior to COVID, did this. And, you know, in a small village in Honduras, often a teacher is hitting students, right, to keep them in line. And the complexity for our students who are coming from the U.S. to say, should I critique this? Should I, you know, is it my place to critique this? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, to do I judge this from my own paradigm or whatever? And those kind of messy things are sometimes really, really valuable for students to work through, and for all of us to work through.
Yeah. Love that, because I tell this to people all the time. We believe that this work should end with sort of this, I always say it's almost like when the sun comes up and it's like, you know, all is well in the world. And I'm like, that's really not equity and inclusion in my mind. It really is messy. And maneuvering the messy is the power. The fact that we can realize that there can be multiple right answers for any given conversation. And what does that look like? You know, I always say, you know, social justice is a synergy in the middle. You know, yes, we can be polarized, but it's when we get to that spot where we are like, oh, you know, doesn't mean that we agree, but we can coexist in a space. I'm very, very clear that when people, I love when people come up to me, mostly student affairs folks and higher ed folks, and go, isn't it the worst it's ever been, Vernon, in our country around issues of inclusion? Isn't it the worst it's ever been? I'm like, there was slavery, and there was maybe internment camps for Japanese Americans, and there were indigenous folks who were murdered, and no, it's not worse. I think that the thing that we need to really keep in mind, and my mother did it so eloquently one time, I was sitting at the dinner table, because I mean, she loves to ask me about my work and stuff, because in the Presbyterian Church, for a number of years, she sort of did some race work. She's pretty savvy for an 82-year-old woman, you know, in terms of issues of inclusion. And plus she's an old former high school teacher. But one of the things she said to me, which really helped me put it in all in perspective, and I think about this every day, is remember going to either a family function or a party or a dinner or hanging out with a group of friends. And there's this one person who just starts to share a quote unquote conspiracy theory or something. And everybody just goes, oh, well, that's just Uncle Jack, or they may move down a road of being pretty, pretty sexist or racist. And we just kind of go, oh, well, she said, now picture that moment and think about social media, because the reality is those people have existed since the beginning of time. It's just now we can't turn away from it. And she always makes this good point. And I have to really, it's hard for people to get, because when you're in it, you don't, when you see it happen around you and you've got, my mother goes, keep in mind, Vernon, when you were growing up, there was ABC, NBC, and CBS, and PBS for children. That was it. And we didn't realize how controlled our news cycles were until we are here today, and there's so much, and anybody can say anything and post it anywhere. So those conversations that used to happen at the dinner table are now on social media. And I went, oh my God, you're exactly right. So I don't fall into this trap of, it's so horrible right now for historically marginalized groups. It's always been horrible. I mean, I'm like, let's just let that go, because yeah, I mean, and we continue to be about hope and liberation in this country. And that's what keeps us going. We may take, three steps forward, but then we take two steps back, then we'll take three more steps forward. And that's going to be how we're going to be. I don't know what people think it's how it's going to be different, but that doesn't in any way mean that I'm not going to continue to do the work that I do, because I do believe that we are planting seeds that allow for there to be some great conversation. So, yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about Uncle Jack at the dinner table. And I mean, at the dinner table in the holidays or whatever, maybe in that room, everybody's moving away from Uncle Jack. But as soon as he posts on social media, there are a whole bunch of people. He has a willing audience all of a sudden. And that, so there is kind of a different forum that Uncle Jack has. And I have an Uncle Jack, by the way. Well, what I hear a little bit is you've talked about, when I asked you, kind of the future, and particularly the future of this inclusion and social justice work. We're not in any more dire situation, but we are, but it still is going to continue to be an issue that needs attention. And because it's not a project that you can see a completion to, right? It's just one of the things when you were talking about the, these institutions and what institutions do, the work I've been doing and writing on, it strikes me, and I just wrote this a couple of days ago, that when there's a crisis on campus, I think, of course, institutions want to show that they're doing something,
Mm-hmm.
And that's what institutions do, right? And often it isn't, it is about demonstrating something, and symbolically that could be valuable or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe there are two reasons for that. You know, let's just show we're doing something, because one, these issues are so large and deep that sometimes we don't even know what to do, right? And the second thing is, if we do it, it's going to be really hard. Mm-hmm. And so it could be one of, you know, two of those things that are kind of intertwined, but mm-hmm. but it is a whole lot easier, because what institutions do is kind of protect themselves, protect their image, try to look after their own viability. And often, this is kind of cynical, but aren't necessarily focused primarily on, you know, student learning, student outcomes, mm-hmm. you know, being an agent of betterment for society, but, you know, that we automatically become mm-hmm. about preservation and of our own image and reputation and all that as an institution. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I'd agree. I think that, you know, the tough thing that we struggle with in higher education, specifically around equity and inclusion, is being proactive and not reactive only. Because typically when we think of equity and inclusion, it's something, an incident happens on campus and we react. But my whole thing is, what are we doing when we're not in crisis? Now, I know that during the pandemics, we have been pretty much in crisis. However, there have been times when I think there's opportunities in what I call downtimes for us to be talking about equity and inclusion to prepare for the times when there are incidents that happen. And you know, lately I've been using the example of JetBlue and how we remember when they were upcoming, you know, an upstart airline sort of competing with Southwest and really getting some traction because they were kind of the classier budget airline, and just the way that they were marketing themselves really had them really moving to a space quickly of competing with Southwest. And then that fateful day in New York City when a plane was on the runway for, I think, 7 hours because of miscommunication, and they wouldn't let passengers move around. They wouldn't let them use a restaurant. I mean, it was just most horrible thing, most horrible PR ever. And I think a lot of folks thought, that's it, JetBlue's going down because there's no way they can survive this. But what they did was brilliant. And that is, number one, they said, we apologize, we were wrong, we're gonna fix this. Now, we all know during that time, airlines never apologize. So that was huge. And then secondly, they came out a few weeks later with the Passenger's Bill of Rights. And they basically said, here's what you can guarantee that we will guarantee these 10 things or whatever they were anytime you fly with us. If we don't live up to this, we will refund your money. And every airline freaked out because they're like, oh my God, oh no. And now, fast forward however many years it is later, every airline has a Passenger Bill of Rights because JetBlue said, hold on, we're gonna take responsibility. We're going to do something. So I use that analogy to say, I would love for campuses to start talking about what do we pledge to do around equity and inclusion for the next two, three, four, five, six years, you know, map it out and then say, and be ready. And, you know, have some statements, not mission statements, but have some tangible things that folks will do rather than wait until there is a crisis to happen. Why can't we be in that space?
As you were talking about early on, systematize things, put structure, you know, do some of the deeper structure of it, that so it's not always just a response to an issue. One thing I wanted to just kind of focus on is, and I'm sort of shifting gears, but, you know, I mentioned to you appreciative inquiry is one of the foundations of what I'm doing, and that is, kind of operating under the belief that to have the best future we can have, we should build on the best parts of the experiences we've had so far. What have been the really life-giving experiences in our work with students, in your work in social justice and inclusion education with others? What are What are some bright spots for you that you think could be, and maybe a story or something about an interaction or a time or a conversation or whatever that that you think, oh my gosh, this is what this work should be, and this really defines this, and I feel so good about what happened here.
Well, I mean, the very first thing that came to mind was our Social Justice Training Institute. I think that I am blessed that I have been able to be a part of several faculty teams over the years and continue to learn and grow from not only my fellow faculty, but also to the participants in the room. It's just a wonderful laboratory to get folks to sort of unpack their marginalized and privileged identities and to, you know, have community with each other. What I like about it is the Social Justice Training Institute doesn't treat everyone the same as you're going through the experience. So for instance, we do an immersion on race where we basically have everybody participate in a 2-day workshop on race and racism and the dynamics. And so we ask the people to stay in race for 2 days. And so based on your identities, what's cool is, you know, white folks get to kind of look at race in the paradigm of privilege. And then people of color look at it not only, you know, as people of color, but also to individually as Asian American, as multiracial, and cross race stuff, you know, in terms of, you know, what is the anti-blackness in Asian American communities. And, you know, it's so, and it really, I think that that's what I love about it is everybody can enter it in a way that they can take something out based on who they are in terms of their identities. And so that's been really powerful for me because I can tell you, and we have grown as a faculty because early on in 1998, we realized that there were four of us as a faculty and we were on the black white binary. I mean, it was Jamie and I, and then, you know, Kathy and Mara. I mean, it's like, that doesn't really help with the race conversation. And then, you know, how do we, you know, as we talk, I think about how the curriculum has shifted, even though we have the same concepts, we've been open to shifting with our population. Like for instance, multiracial, biracial folks, as they began to enter the community and feel that they didn't have a place, because how do you choose when you're multiracial, biracial? You know, when we say get into race caucuses, we know we need to still get into race caucuses, but owning the fact that it's tough and it hurts for people who identify as multiracial, biracial. And then as we move forward to broadening the term Asian American, looking at very specifically folks from the Middle East and South Asian, and what is that, those dynamics. And it's just been, and now as we move, Chris Salinas down at, where is he at, Florida International University, just released this great thought paper on the term Latinx and how that term is not inclusive. People say it is, but if you identify as Chicana, you really wanna hold on to that identity. It's very important, or Puerto Rican, you wanna hold on to that. And by just using the term Latinx, it doesn't allow for people to hold on to things that they really truly believe. And keep in mind that the term was absolutely developed with no malice or ill will. It's just important to know that.
In fact, the opposite is developed as an inclusive,
right?
You know, term. Right. Yeah.
And yes. And so it just goes back to what you talked about. What I love is the complexity of it. I mean, I know a lot of people think the opposite. People, oh my God, it's so complex. It's hard. I welcome the complexity because that allows us to be human and to say, okay, we're going to navigate this together. What does it look like? You know, we're not going to tie it up in a little bow and wrap it all up and racism's all in this little box, all gone now. No, it's going to be messy and it's going to be, but there are going to be small victories. So that's the first thing. I'd say that. I remember it really wasn't until after graduate school that I started to, I remember reading the book Blacks in College by Jackie Fleming? One of the very first books that was written on race on a college campus in my master's program way, way back. And I remember reading it going, why didn't somebody give this to me before I went to college? It was really pretty much reading a snapshot of my life in a predominantly white institution. And it wasn't until after reading that book that I started to think about me as a raced being, because I grew up in a house with my mom and dad, both parents, teachers. And so education was a part of our family. I mean, I knew history, I knew Black history, I knew all history. My parents weren't afraid to share things that weren't in textbooks that we needed to know. And then I went to a predominantly white campus, pretty much college campus being sort of under the radar. I mean, I was a student leader, but I was more of this, you know, I always tell people, I was seen as sort of this person that represented everyone, you know. So, you know, I would run for offices or be an RA or something. And I just kind of stayed under the radar in a way. And I know that I did it because I didn't want there to be race and racism at me. Mm-hmm. And knowing there was definitely things happening around me, but I never really felt things coming toward me. Even growing up in North Carolina, I mean, and I even tell myself, have I suppressed some things or something? But then, you know, as I talk to my family and we say, no, I mean, it's just, that was just not a part of our narrative growing up, that someone would say the N-word or do something around us. I mean, I look back and there were certain things that were said that were like, okay, that's pretty mm-hmm. problematic, but in the moment didn't think about it. But I do believe that though that really propelled me, that book propelled me to start thinking about, so when I'm in the profession, what am I going to do around race and racism? But typical me, I didn't go to race and racism first. I mean, I went towards sexual orientation first and did a lot of research and conversations around that before. I think the turning point was when Jamie and I decided to do the first chapter on GLBT people of color that was in the Beyond Tolerance book. That sort of got us thinking we need to start doing more and more around race. And sort of that was the big turning point for me there. So, but yeah, student-wise, it's hard for me to pick a moment, because there's been so many great opportunities I've had, not only when I was a professional on campus, but also too, just traveling, as you mentioned. I mean, being on campus, I'm never concerned when I'm brought in to work with students, because students are amazing. They are truly, truly amazing. Just to watch them sort of grapple and ask questions and navigate. And yes, it can be messy. They can stumble a little bit every now and then, but for the most part, you know, I believe our country is, our world is in good hands, because these are some critical thinkers out there that are really ready to do some things. When I'm brought to campus by deans, provosts, and presidents, that's probably when I'm the most frustrated, because I just want to just shake them and go, you've got to be kidding me. Come on. These students are further along than you are. Come on. So it's hard for me to pick student experience, because I just had so many, semester at sea, similar to your experience as you've, when you leave the country, that was pivotal for me, for making sure that I saw myself as someone who was born in the United States, and the privilege that goes along with that, and how do you navigate the world and the communities around you in a way that is appreciative and welcoming and not arrogant. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go back on semester at sea in 2025, I think it is. I don't know. It's coming up.
Wow.
So excited to go back after so many years to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm wondering, I would be remiss if I don't ask yet. I hadn't thought about this in advance. I guess we just have a few minutes here, but
we're fine. I have nothing after this.
Yeah, but, you know, call out culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because I mean, and I hadn't really thought about this until you start talking about today's students and, you know, we're in good hands and all that. But there's so much, like, I even just read this. I was reading this book on morality. I don't think I have it right here around me, but it's a Jewish guy. And so much of it is like very progressive thinking about how we need to actually move more toward a community consciousness rather than, you know, individual. But then he says one of our big problems, he identifies like three or four big problems in the world. And one of them in his mind is call out culture. Mm-hmm. And it just struck me that, Yeah, I mean, even somebody here who's on this, you know, kind of community focus, pretty liberal voice, progressive voice, is saying this. So, what do you how do you sort of think about that issue right now?
Yeah, I love to be vocal about this. For me, it's about developing the accountability culture, because what I always have folks talk about is when you're moving to a space that you want to call someone out, what is your intended outcome? I always ask that question first. Is it to engage the person, to have a conversation, or is it to show people that you have more knowledge about this topic than they do? I mean, I say, let's break it down here. What is your intended outcome? You know, I always talk about on Facebook, when somebody posts something and someone says, but what about? It's like, well, wait a minute. Are you basically saying that what you're sharing is more important than the person that just shared? Or are you saying, I'm joining this person? What's your language? There are ways in which I can have a conversation with someone and hold them accountable and myself accountable. I love the community perspective. It's us together. So if we're having a conversation and I want to challenge you in some sort of way, I want to be in this with you. So we're going to learn together. So because in that challenge, you may share something that I may go, oh, wait a minute, I never thought about that. So I truly want people to just think as they are in a space of calling someone out, what's your intended outcome? Is it for there to be learning and growth? Or you just want to just show that you are all knowing on this topic, and what does that look like? And I do believe that there is this tendency, and I don't know if it's generational, because I mean, there've been some call out cultures. I mean, there's been sort of a call out culture for years. It's just framed differently. Now it's cancel culture. Everybody just frames it differently each generation. And we just need to think about what is our intent in the conversation?
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, again, back to my point about, and especially, I guess, I think early in my faculty time, I was teaching, we had student development theory and multicultural student development theory. How about that, Vernon? I mean, we're going to talk about the white people here in the first semester, and then we're first quarter. Actually, when we went from quarters to semesters is when we integrated it, and it's been a lot healthier way of doing it, because we're, you know, just integrating and doing, you know, student development theory. Yeah. I mean, just identity, for instance, whether it be white, you know, Black, Asian American, you know, Latinx, Chicana, you know, and so we try to really kind of deal with those things in an integrated way. But one thing it struck me that I think maybe particularly with a lot of our white students, you know, wanting to understand the language, first of all, because they legitimately don't want to be offensive. And what you kind of, what you grow to understand is that there's no easy recipe for this, right? I mean, you know, that's one thing. But the other thing is that I think because sometimes of white shame and guilt kind of thing, people in a developmental, you know, a certain point, you know, want to feel better about themselves. So by calling out, you know, grandpa or whatever, I mean, it's, you know, it's, or Uncle Jack, you know, it is, you know, at least that's a way to assuage that somewhat, because I know the rules and I'm doing something. And back to your point about being an activist, right? I mean, you know, because this is easy, right? I mean, it's easier to understand. I want to differentiate myself from that other. And what I think is sometimes I need to understand how racism is always, I mean, it's part of me. Mm-hmm. Sexism is part of me. And I hope that students will learn that about themselves too. And it's not like always an us and them kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like just that person's got racism. And to me, there's a difference between saying I'm a racist and I've got racism as part of my
totally
being, you know. Yeah. That's what I want people to understand, that, you know.
Yeah, that's one of that's a frustrating thing for me, is when we move to the space of, you know, calling someone a racist, because, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that's a cop out, because the reality is they can either say yes or no. And I'm like, nah, that's not really what I'm trying to do. I mean, I don't know who you are in your being, in your soul. What I do is say, I focus on action, specific action. So what you did seemed to me to be oppressive in some sort of way. And this is why,
right.
You know,
right.
and I really focus on the act. But I notice in call out culture, we love to really, truly go toward calling someone something. And I'm like, oh, really? Yeah. Like I'm reading, Jamie actually sent me I believe that anytime there is resistance, it's important for you to really engage the resistance, because typically when there's resistance or critique, there is usually a sliver of truth in the critique, and we can use that in order to be better. So for instance, you know, this whole critical race theory critique that's happening now, I embrace it because there are actually people who are out there who are doing harmful work around talking about race and racism as a trainer or facilitator. And I'll be the first to say that I want us to have accurate information in order to be better. And so, you know, one of the things that is mentioned in this article, it talks about, it's basically how to recognize when critical race theory is happening on your campus and how to stop it or something. It's really definitely I'm reading through it and it's written well. And the thing that gets me is there's one part that says that basically whiteness is bad. And I'm thinking that people are saying that whiteness is bad. And I'm thinking, I don't know where that narrative is, because racism is bad. We all are contributing to racism. I am sometimes, as a Black person, colluding and being silent. That's contributing to racism. So whiteness isn't in itself bad. And privilege equals opportunity. And so it's been interesting to read this because the framing that they're having is telling. And I can see sometimes people sharing that. I've been in a session one time where people would talk about how, you know, whiteness is bad. And I'm like, no, it's not. Not in and of itself. The dynamics are, this article also talks about saying that our country is racist. And once again, I would never call our country racist. I would say there are race dynamics that are happening in our country, some positive, some negative, you know, and we can kind of work it out. So it's interesting, the language that they're using that critics are using in order to frame things. So, but I think it's important for us to know that and not push away from it, because that's what we typically do in higher education. And that's gotten us in trouble already, is we try to be this elite group of scholars and thinkers that other folks believe that we're out of touch. Mm-hmm. And that's how many people are being heard now, or they feel that they're being heard, because there are folks who are tapping into people who feel that they've been left behind. And so you've got this group of people who feel left behind, who are listening, yeah, just completely falsehoods. And it's so interesting to watch that. It's like, even when you know it's false, you're still, oh, good Lord. Okay. All right.
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard sometimes to allow yourself to engage in conversations that are helpful when so much of there's this media polarization. There's this, you know, I mean, there is this real polarization, and people, this may be a parallel. This is one thing I think about, again, from a Honduras experience. I wrote an article with a couple of students. One was actually from a North Carolina native. She was a lesbian white woman who came from kind of a high poverty background. Then, you know, ended up doing well in college, was always talked about trying to pass as a middle-class person, actually in college. And then she, she really kind of, as she identified herself as lower income and lesbian, and she started really kind of getting, you know, more empowered by that and all that. And she went to Honduras, and she was in this position where the folks she was interacting with in Honduras were, I mean, she was more privileged in some ways, you know, as you kind of talked about. You go to semester at CE, you dock in certain places, and you're saying, I know I have certain privileges by virtue of economics or whatever that allows me to do this, professional experience and stuff. But anyway, there was this woman, there was another woman who was from Japan, who was a master's student in our critical theory class. And our hosts were these really evangelical Christians who are Mexican in Honduras working with a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And the woman who was our host was walking these two women around the house. And she said, you know, Jesus tells me to do that, you know, this and that. Well, the woman from who had really embraced this kind of liberal, you know, attitude was like, I'm not comfortable with this. She didn't say anything, but she kind of felt herself withdraw from it. And the Japanese woman who's not been part of this culture in the same way said, how does this Jesus talk to you? Like, what do you mean Jesus is talking to you? Isn't Jesus dead? You know, kind of thing. The other woman, the one who's, again, from the U.S., ran into the other room and said, Pete, the most amazing thing that happened. You know, Makiko is asking these, like, honest questions. And boy, I wish I could have done that. But I am so embedded in this. I withdraw as a lesbian woman. You know, when somebody starts talking about, you know, with this evangelical Christian voice, I am withdrawing from it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not. And I want to be able to lean into that a little bit more and ask those questions. I love the international stuff because it does, and particularly when your group is diverse too, you know, going into a country, the way people, the different lenses that people see things and how the rich learning that happens, because it breaks us a little bit out of our cultural paradigm that we're so steeped in. Well, Vernon, I really appreciate this. Is there any final parting shots you have for me?
Well, if I could sort of put it in a snapshot, the future for me would be about us as a campus community being more nimble in terms of navigating issues of inclusion, meaning that as dynamics shift and change, we shift and change with them. We can't be stagnant. The fact that there was a time when we talked about Black students and then it changed African-American students. And then there was a time when we didn't talk about transgender students and now we do. There was a time when we didn't even know the term cisgender and we use it as if we have always been part of our language. I mean, we've got to really allow for there to be nuances and moving. I still believe that on our campuses, we're using the same programs and services and interventions that we did in the 90s. And that is not meeting the need of our current student. To have a Office of Multicultural Affairs may not be what students right now want or need. And so what does it mean to navigate? Or those offices need to adjust as students continue to become more and more savvy around language. What I've found is a good number of students have grown up now knowing that there's diversity. There are people that are different from you, and there are some words you probably shouldn't use, especially around them, and you know how to navigate some of that. But I don't think that many of us haven't moved past the language in terms of community building and developing relationships with people across different backgrounds. And so what can we do in order to enhance that as we move forward? And our campuses will continue to be, depending on the community, be fairly diverse. And I do believe that our two-year colleges are continually left out of the conversation. If we didn't have community colleges and two-year colleges, higher education, I don't even know what we would be. I don't think we realize the importance of two-year colleges and what we can learn from them. I always said that at the beginning of the pandemic, we were all struggling and running around trying to decide how we were going to move to a virtual place without even asking community colleges, who many of them have been doing this for decades. And why did we develop this dust storm around moving to a virtual experience without talking with our colleagues at for-profit and community colleges? I mean, I think that's it for me. The other piece would be allowing for our senior leaders to be a part of experiences where they can learn and grow around equity and inclusion and be able to be better on their college campuses, because now your success as a senior leader on a college campus will be judged or evaluated based on how you engage issues of inclusion. I mean, that's all it is to it. I mean, you cannot be on a campus these days and be a senior leader and not know how to navigate issues of equity and inclusion. And so that means if you don't have the skill, you better develop it, because students are going to continue to be vocal. And as I mentioned earlier, instead of waiting for the demands to come to your desk, develop your own set of demands as an institution or as a department.
I'm just reminded when I was interim dean of University College and I was sitting on a dean's provost group, and we had had an issue. I don't even remember what the particular issue was on campus, but there was some conversation as among the deans, like, what should we do? One of the deans said, you know, I was at Mississippi State in the late 1960s. You know, everybody was fine. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's sad. I wish, you know, things were more like there. But now, you know, I don't know what it is about our current climate, you know, that our students of color don't feel welcome.
I think, Pete, what you're mentioning is really important, because I believe what's happening too in our country right now is there is this feeling of helplessness and loss among people who are white, or people in privileged identities, because growing up, you could pretty much silo yourself away from the hurt, pain, and anger that was happening in the world. You could, because that's what privilege does. But now, the fact that you see a Black man murdered on television right in front of you, you can't unsee it. And I think there's this tension about a lot of white folks are saying, oh my God, what have I missed over the last 50 years of my life or whatever?
Yeah.
And trying to make sense of it. And I totally get that. And that's a clear example of not saying that that person in that meeting was wrong. That was their worldview based on their experience that they've
had. That's the way they understood it.
That's the way they understood it. And we gotta be in that space, because right now we're having people who are really struggling because they're going, I really want to do something, but I'm still struggling with the fact that I didn't know this was happening, or I'm rationalizing how it happened so that it minimizes my hurt around racism by trying to find a reason why that Black man was murdered that wasn't about race helps me then with my past that I've not dealt with the race yet. So all of that is just so fascinating to me. I'm really in a space now where I'm more around empathy than anger. I understand the feeling of loss and frustration that, you know, now you're seeing all of these things bombarded at you in terms of visually that have been happening for centuries, but now you can't turn away from it.
And don't you think that, I mean, it was true to some extent in the civil rights movement in the 60s too, right? Like, you would see visuals that people had never seen before, right? And it was a wake up call for me.
It was. Yeah. You know, that one photo that everybody shows of the attack dogs is one that truly shifted our country. Because, you know, if you're in rural areas and you don't know, you just don't know. You just live in your life, and you're in your community, and you've got Black people who, you know, you wave at and all is well, you think. And then you see this photo and you're like, what? And I believe that's a good analogy. I think that's what's happening now with us, is that you know, the marches that happened. And I will say in Washington, D.C., you know, during the marches for justice, what was really striking to me, and I've been to several marches, you know, throughout my life, but these marches, the diversity of people was striking. I mean, white folks everywhere, lots of young folks, lots of college students, intergenerational. I mean, that made me realize, oh, people are noticing. Because typically, if you'd go to a march that dealt with equity or inclusion, it would be mostly people of color. And that was not the case in Washington, D.C. In March. Every march that I think I went to maybe three different protests, and every one of them, children, families, I was like, this is cool. That's why I do have hope, because there's so much energy around change. And yes, it's going to be tough. It's going to be rocky. But you know, that MLK quote always sticks with me. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice always. That's exactly what we're seeing.
And I was thinking about that quote earlier when you were talking about like how a lot of people think we're in a really bad place. And I think it's because in a way, you know, you sometimes see these signals that things are getting better, like marriage equality, you know, or, I mean, that happens, you know, in a policy thing. And then you're like, oh my God, we're in a new world where, you know, and then all of a sudden, what just happened?
It's just fascinating to me. And it's like, you know, this whole voting rights piece, I'm like, you mean, what? You want to limit people voting?
Well, Vernon, thank you so much. And I'm definitely grateful for your time.
Yeah. Anytime you want to pull together and unpack, you know, another question or two, feel free to let me know. We can jump on real quick.
All right. Well, Vernon, thanks a lot. Take care. Enjoy your time in Hartford, and then after that.
Yeah. So Well, you enjoy your time in AIM.